Brianna had told him all right, making it clear in no uncertain terms what she thought of that particular proposal. He steeled himself to repeat her objections now, hoping to do it more tactfully than she might have done herself. He cleared his throat.
"I'm sure my wife is most conscious of the honour, Mrs. Cameron,"
he began cautiously. "But
is she?"
Jocasta asked dryly.
"I shouldn't have thought so to hear her talk. But doubtless you ken her mind better than I do. Be that as it may, though, I mean to tell her that I've changed my own mind."
"Oh, well, I'm sure she'll..."
"I've told Gerald Forbes to be drawing up a will, leaving River Run and all its contents to Jeremiah."
"To..." It took a moment for his brain to make the connection.
"What? To wee Jimmy?"
She was still leaning forward a little, as though peering at his face. Now she sat back, nodding, still holding firmly to his hand. It came to him finally that, unable to see his face, she thought to read him by means of this physical connection. She was welcome to anything his fingers might tell her, he thought. He was too stunned at this news to have any notion how to respond to it. Christ, what would Bree say about it?
"Aye," she said, and smiled pleasantly. "It came to me, you see, as how a woman's property becomes her husband's when she weds. Not that there are no means of settling it upon her, but it's difficult, and I wouldn't involve lawyers more than I must. I think it always a mistake to go to the law. Do you not agree, Mr. Mackenzie?"
With a sense of complete astonishment, he realised that he was being deliberately insulted. Not only insulted, but warned. She thought. She did. She thought he was after Brianna's presumed inheritance and was warning him not to resort to any legal contortions to get it. Mingled shock and outrage sealed his tongue for a moment, but then he found words.
"Why, that is the most...
So you take thought for Joan Finlay's pride, but you think I have none?
Mrs. Cameron, how dare you suggest that..."
"You're a handsome lad, Thrush," she said, holding tight to his hand. "I've felt your face. And you've the name of Mackenzie, which is a good one, to be sure. But there are Mackenzies aplenty in the Highlands, aren't there? Men of honour, and men without it. Jimmy Roy calls you kinsman. But perhaps that's because you're handfast to his daughter. I dinna think I ken your family." Shock was giving way to a nervous impulse to laugh. Ken his family? Not likely. And how would he explain that he was the grandson, 6 times over, of her own brother Dougal? That he was, in fact, not only Jamie's nephew, but her own as well, if a bit further down the family tree than one might expect.
"Nor does anyone I've spoken to this week at the gathering," she added, head tilted to one side like a hawk watching prey. So that was it. She'd been asking about him among her company, and had failed to turn up anyone who knew anything of his antecedents, for obvious reasons. A suspicious circumstance, to be sure.
This ends Disc 5. The Fiery Cross, Disc 6.
He wondered whether she supposed he was a confidence trickster who had taken Jamie in, or whether perhaps he was meant to be involved in some scheme with Jamie.
No, hardly that.
Bree had told him that Jocasta had originally wanted to leave her property to Jamie, who had refused, wary of close involvement with the old leg trap. His opinion of Jamie's intelligence was reaffirmed. Before he could think of some dignified retort, she patted his hand, still smiling.
"So, I thought to leave it all to the wee lad.
That will be a tidy way of managing, won't it? Brianna will have the use of the money, of course, until wee Jeremiah should come of age. Unless anything should happen to the child, that is." Her voice held a definite note of warning, though her mouth continued to smile, her blank eyes still fixed wide on his face.
"What? What in the name of God do you mean by that?"
He pushed his stool back, but she held tight to his hand. She was very strong, despite her age. Gerald Forbes will be executor of my will, and there are three trustees to manage the property, she explained. If Jeremiah should come to any mischief, though, then everything will go to my nephew Hamish. Her face was quite serious now. You'd not see a penny. He twisted his fingers in hers and squeezed, hard enough that he felt her bony knuckles press together. Let her read what she liked in that, then. She gasped, but he didn't let go. Are you saying to me that you think I would harm that child? His voice sounded hoarse to his own ears. She had gone pale, but kept her dignity, teeth clenched and chin upraised. Have I said so? You've said a great deal, and what you've not said speaks louder than what you have. How dare you imply such things to me? He released her hand, all but flinging it back in her lap. She rubbed her reddened fingers slowly with her other hand, lips pursed in thought. The canvas sides of the tent breathed in the wind with a crackling sound. Well, then, she said at last, I'll offer you my apology, Mr. Mackenzie, if I've wronged you in any way. I thought it would be as well, though, for you to know what was in my mind. As well? As well for whom? He was on his feet and turned toward the flap. With great difficulty he kept himself from seizing the china plates of cakes and biscuits and smashing them on the ground as a parting gesture. For Jeremiah, she said levelly behind him. And Brianna. Perhaps, lad, even for you. He swung round, staring at her. Me? What do you mean by that? She gave the ghost of a shrug. If you canna love the lad for himself, I thought you might treat him well for the sake of his prospects. He stared at her, words jamming in his throat. His face felt hot and the blood throbbed dully in his ears. Oh, I ken how it is, she assured him. It's only to be understood that a man might not feel just so kindly toward a bairn his wife's born to another. But if... He stepped forward then and gripped her hard by the shoulder, startling her. She jerked, blinking, and the candle flames flashed from the cairngorm brooch. Madam, he said, speaking very softly into her face. I do not want your money. My wife does not want it. And my son will not have it. Cram it up your whole eye. He let her go, turned, and strode out of the tent, brushing past Ulysses, who looked after him in puzzlement. Chapter 12. Virtue. People moved through the gathering shadows of late afternoon, visiting from one fireside to another, as they had each day. But there was a different feeling on the mountain today. In part, it was the sweet sadness of leave-taking, the parting of friends, the severing of new-found loves, the knowledge that some faces would be seen tonight for the last time on earth. In part, it was anticipation, the longing for home, the pleasures and dangers of the journey to come. In part, sheer weariness, cranky children, men harried by responsibility, women exhausted by the labour of cooking over open fires, maintaining a family's clothes and health and appetites from the sustenance of saddlebags and mule packs. I could sympathise with all three attitudes myself. Beyond the sheer excitement of meeting new people and hearing new talk, I had had the pleasure, for pleasure it definitely was, despite its grimmer aspects, of new patients, seeing novel ailments, and curing what could be cured, grappling with the need to find a way to treat what could not. But the longing for home was strong. My spacious hearth with its huge cauldron and its roasting jack, the light-filled piece of my surgery with the fragrant bunches of nettle and dried lavender overhead, dusty gold in the afternoon sun, my feather bed, soft and clean, linen sheets smelling of rosemary and yarrow. I closed my eyes for a moment, summoning up a wistful vision of this haven of delight, then opened them to reality. A crusted girdle, black with the remnants of scorched oatcake, soggy shoes and frozen feet, damp clothes that chafed with grit and sand, hampers whose abundance had dwindled to a single loaf of bread, well nibbled by mice, 10 apples and a heel of cheese, 3 screeching babies, 1 frazzled young mother with sore breasts and cracked nipples, 1 expectant bride with a case of incipient nerves, 1 white-faced serving maid with menstrual cramps, 4 slightly inebriated Scotsmen, and 1 Frenchman in similar condition, who wandered in and out of camp like bears and weren't going to be any help whatever in packing up this evening. And a deep, clenching ache in my lower belly that gave me the unwelcome news that my own monthly, which had grown, thankfully, much less frequent than monthly of late, had decided to keep Lizzie's company. I gritted my teeth, plucked a cold, damp clout off a clump of brush, and made my way, duck-footed, down the trail toward the women's privy trench, thighs pressed together. The first thing to greet me on my return was the hot stink of scorching metal. I said something very expressive in French, a useful bit of phraseology acquired at l'Hôpital des Anges, where strong language was often the best medical tool available. Massali's mouth fell open. Germain looked at me in admiration and repeated the expression correctly, and with a beautiful Parisian accent. "Sorry," I said, looking to Massali in apology. "Someone's let the tea kettle boil dry." "Nay matter, Mother Claire," she said with a sigh, juggling little Joni, who'd started to scream again. "It's no worse than the things his father teaches him a purpose. Is there a dry cloth?" I was already hunting urgently for a dry cloth or a pot lifter with which to grasp the wire handle, but nothing came to hand save soggy diapers and damp stockings. Kettles were hard to come by, though, and I wasn't sacrificing this one. I wrapped my hand in a fold of my skirt, seized the handle, and jerked the kettle away from the flames. The heat shot through the damp cloth like a bolt of lightning, and I dropped it.
"Merde," said Germain in happy echo.
"Yes, quite," I said, sucking a blistered thumb. The kettle hissed and smoked in the wet leaves, and I kicked at it, rolling it off onto a patch of mud.
"Merde, merde, merde, merde,"
sang Germain with a fair approximation of the tune of Rose, Rose, a manifestation of precocious musical feeling that went lamentably unappreciated in the circumstances. "Do hush, child," I said. He didn't. Jemmy began to screech in unison with Joan. Lizzie, who had had a relapse owing to the reluctant departure of Private Ogilvy, began to moan under her bush, and it started into hail, small white pellets of ice dancing on the ground and pinging sharply off my scalp. I pulled the soggy mob cap off a branch and clapped it on my head, feeling like an extremely put-upon toad beneath a particularly homely mushroom. All it wanted was warts, I thought. The hail was short-lived. As the rush and clattering lessened, though, the crunching noise of muddy boots came up the path. Jamie, with Father Kenneth Donoghue in tow, crusted hail on their hair and shoulders.
"I've brought the good father for tea," he said, beaming round the clearing.
"No, you haven't," I said, rather ominously. And if he'd thought I'd forgotten about Stephen Bonnet, he was wrong about that, too. Turning at the sound of my voice, he jerked in an exaggeration of startled shock at sight of me in my mob cap.
"Is that you, Sassenach?"
he asked in mock alarm, pretending to lean forward and peek under the drooping frill of my cap. Owing to the presence of the priest, I refrained from kneeing Jamie in some sensitive spot, and contented myself, instead, with an attempt to turn him into stone with my eyes, a la Medusa. He appeared not to notice, distracted by Germain, who was now dancing in little circles while singing theme and variations on my initial French expression to the tune of "Row, row, row your boat." Father Donoghue was going bright pink with the effort of pretending that he didn't understand any French.
"Tais-toi, crétin," Jamie said, reaching into his sporran.
He said it amiably enough, but with the tone of one whose expectation of being obeyed is so absolute as to not to admit question. Germain stopped abruptly, mouth open, and Jamie promptly thumbed a sweetie into it. Germain shut his mouth and began concentrating on the matter at hand, songs forgotten. I reached for the kettle, using a handful of my hem again as potholder. Jamie bent, picked up a sturdy twig, and hooked the handle of the tea kettle neatly from my hand with it.
Voila, he said, presenting it.
Merci, I said, with a distinct lack of gratitude. Nonetheless, I accepted the stick and set off toward the nearest rivulet, smoking kettle borne before me like a lance. Reaching a rock-studded pool, I dropped the kettle with a clang, ripped off the mob cap, flung it into a clump of sedge, and stamped on it, leaving a large, muddy footprint on the linen.
I didn't mean to say it wasn't a flattering, Sassenach, said an amused voice behind me.
I raised a cold brow in his direction.
You didn't mean to say it was flattering, did you?
No, it makes you look like a poisonous toadstool.
Much better without, he assured me.
He pulled me toward him and bent to kiss me.
It's not that I don't appreciate the thought, I said, and the tone of my voice stopped him a fraction of an inch from my mouth. But one inch further, and I think I might just bite a small piece out of your lip.
Moving like a man who has just realized that the stone he's casually picked up is in actuality a wasp's nest, he straightened up and very, very slowly took his hands off my waist.
Oh,
he said, and tilted his head to one side, lips pursed as he surveyed me.
You do look a bit frazzled at that, Sassenach.
No doubt this was true, but it made me feel like bursting into tears to hear it. Evidently the urge showed, because he took me very gently by the hand and led me to a large rock.
Sit, he said. Close your eyes, Aniandun. Rest yourself a moment.
I sat, eyes closed and shoulders slumped. Sloshing noises and a muted clang announced that he was cleaning and filling the kettle. He set the filled kettle at my feet with a soft clunk, then eased himself down on the leaves beside it, where he sat quietly. I could hear the faint sigh of his breath, and the occasional sniff and rustle as he wiped a dripping nose on his sleeve. "I'm sorry," I said at last, opening my eyes. He turned, half-smiling, to look up at me.
"For what, Sassenach? It's not as though you've refused my bed. Or at least, I hope it's not come to that yet."
The thought of making love just at the moment was absolutely at the bottom of my list, but I returned the half-smile.
"No," I said ruefully. "After 2 weeks of sleeping on the ground, I wouldn't refuse anyone's bed."
His eyebrows went up at that, and I laughed, taken off guard.
"No," I said again. "I'm just frazzled."
Something griped low in my belly and proceeded to twist. I grimaced and pressed my hands over the pain.
"Oh,"
he said again, in sudden understanding.
"That kind of frazzled."
"That kind of frazzled," I agreed.
I poked at the kettle with one toe.
"I'd better take that back. I need to boil water so I can steep some willow bark. It takes a long time."
It did. It would take an hour or more, by which time the cramps would be considerably worse.
"The hell with willow bark," he said,
producing a silver flask from the recesses of his shirt.
"Try this. At least you didn't need to boil it first."
I unscrewed the stopper and inhaled. Whiskey. And very good whiskey, too. "I love you," I said sincerely. And he laughed.
"I love you too, Sassenach,"
he said, and gently touched my foot. I took a mouthful and let it trickle down the back of my throat. It seeped pleasantly through my mucous membranes, hit bottom, and rose up in a puff of soothing amber-coloured smoke that filled all my crevices and began to extend warm, soothing tendrils round the source of my discomfort.
"Ooh," I said, sighing, and taking another sip.
I closed my eyes the better to appreciate it.
An Irishman of my acquaintance had once assured me that very good whiskey could raise the dead.
I wasn't disposed to argue the point.
"That's wonderful," I said, when I opened my eyes again. "Where did you get it?"
This was 20-year-old Scotch, if I knew anything about it, a far cry from the raw spirit that Jamie had been distilling on the ridge behind the house.
"Jocasta," he said, "it was meant to be a wedding gift for Brianna and her young man, but I thought you needed it more."
"You're right about that."
We sat in a companionable silence, and I sipped slowly, the urge to run amok and slaughter everyone in sight gradually subsiding, along with the level of whiskey in the flask. The rain had moved off again, and the foliage dripped peacefully around us. There was a stand of fir trees near. I could smell the cool scent of their resin, pungent and clean above the heavier smell of wet, dead leaves, smouldering fires, and soggy fabrics.
"It's been 3 months since the last of your courses," Jamie observed casually. "I thought they'd maybe stopped."
I was always a trifle taken aback to realise how acutely he observed such things. But he was a farmer and a husbandman, after all. He was intimately acquainted with the gynaecological history and estrus cycle of every female animal he owned. I suppose there was no reason to think he'd make an exception, simply because I wasn't likely either to farrow or come in heat. "It's not like a tap that just switches off, you know," I said rather crossly. "Unfortunately, it just gets rather erratic and eventually it stops, but you haven't any idea when."
"Ah."
He leaned forward, arms folded across the tops of his knees, idly watching twigs and bits of leaf bobbing through the riffles of the stream.
"I think it would be maybe a relief to have done with it all. Less mess, eh?"
I repressed the urge to draw invidious sexual comparisons regarding bodily fluids.
"Maybe it will," I said. "I'll let you know, shall I?" He smiled faintly, but was wise enough not to pursue the matter. He could hear the edge in my voice. I sipped a bit more whiskey. The sharp cry of a woodpecker, the kind Jamie called a yaffle, echoed deep in the woods and then fell silent. Few birds were out in this weather. Most simply huddled under what shelter they could find, though I could hear the conversational quacking of a small flock of migratory ducks somewhere downstream. They weren't bothered by the rain. Jamie stretched himself suddenly.
Sassenach, he said.
"What is it?" I asked, surprised. He ducked his head, uncharacteristically shy.
"I dinna ken whether I've done wrong or no, Sassenach, but if I have, I must ask your forgiveness."
"Of course," I said, a little uncertainly. What was I forgiving him for? Probably not adultery, but it could be just about anything else, up to and including assault, arson, highway robbery, and blasphemy. God, I hoped it wasn't anything to do with Bonnet.
"What have you done?" "Well, as to myself, nothing," he said a little sheepishly. "It's only what I've said you'd do."
"Oh," I said, with minor suspicion. "And what's that? If you told Farquhar Campbell that I'd visit his horrible old mother again..."
"Oh, no," he assured me. "Nothing like that. I promised Josiah Beardsley that you'd maybe take out his tonsils today, though."
"That I'd what?" I goggled at him. I'd met Josiah Beardsley, a youth with the worst-looking set of abscessed tonsils I'd ever seen the day before. I'd been sufficiently impressed by the postulated state of his adenoids, in fact, to have described them in detail to all and sundry over dinner, causing Lizzie to go green round the gills and give her second potato to Germaine, and had mentioned at the time that surgery was really the only possible effective cure. I hadn't expected Jamie to go drumming up business, though.
"Why?" I asked.
Jamie rocked back a little, looking up at me.
"I want him, Sassenach."
"You do? What for?"
Josiah was barely 14, or at least he thought he was 14. He wasn't really sure when he'd been born, and his parents had died too long ago to say. He was undersized even for 14, and badly nourished, with legs slightly bowed from rickets. He also showed evidence of assorted parasitic infections, and wheezed with what might be tuberculosis or merely a bad case of bronchitis.
A tenant, of course.
Oh, I'd have thought you had more applicants than you can handle as it is.
I didn't just think so. I knew so.
We had absolutely no money, though the trade Jamie had done at the gathering had just about, not quite, cleared our indebtedness to several of the Cross Creek merchants for ironmongery, rice, tools, salt, and other small items. We had land in plenty, most of it forest, but no means to assist people to settle on it or farm it. The Chisholms and McGilvrys were stretching well past our limits in terms of acquiring new tenantry. Jamie merely nodded, dismissing these complications.
Aye, Josiah's a likely lad, though.
I said dubiously.
It was true that the boy seemed tough, which was likely what Jamie meant by likely. Simply to have survived this long by himself was evidence of that.
Maybe so. Well, so are lots of others. What's he got that makes you want him specially?
He's 14.
I looked at him, one brow raised in question, and his mouth twisted in a wry smile.
Any man between 16 and 60 must serve in the militia, Sassenach.
I felt a small, unpleasant contraction in the pit of my stomach. I hadn't forgotten the governor's unwelcome summons, but what with one thing and another, I hadn't had the leisure to reflect on exactly what the practical consequences of it were likely to be. Jamie sighed and stretched out his arms, flexing his knuckles until they cracked.
"So you'll do it?" I asked.
"Form a militia company and go?"
"I must,"
he said simply.
"Thryan's got my bollocks in his hand, and I'm no inclined to see whether he'll squeeze."
I was afraid of that. Jamie's picturesque assessment of the situation was unfortunately accurate. Looking for a loyal and competent man willing to undertake the settlement of a large section of wild backcountry, Governor Tryon had offered Jamie a royal grant of land just east of the treaty line, with no requirement of quitrent for a period of 10 years. A fair offer, though, given the difficulties of settlement in the mountains, not quite so generous as it might have looked. The catch was that holders of such grants were legally required to be white Protestant males of good character, above the age of 30. And while Jamie met the other requirements, Tryon was well aware of his Catholicism.
Do as the governor required, and... Well, the governor was a successful politician. He knew how to keep his mouth shut about inconvenient matters. Defy him, though, and it would take no more than a simple letter from New Bern to deprive Fraser's Ridge of its resident Frasers.
So you're thinking that if you take the available men from the Ridge, can't you leave out a few?
I haven't got so many to start with, Sassenach,
he pointed out.
I can leave Fergus because of his hand, and Mr. Weems to look after our place. He's a born servant, so far as anyone knows, and only freemen are obliged to join the militia.
And only able-bodied men. That lets out Joanna Grant's husband. He's got a wooden foot. He nodded.
Aye, and old Archbug, who's 70 if he's a day. That's 4 men, and maybe 8 boys under 16, to look after 30 homesteads and more than 150 people.
The women can probably manage fairly well by themselves, I said. It's winter, after all, no crops to deal with. And there shouldn't be any difficulties with the Indians, not these days. My ribbon had come loose when I pulled off the cap. Hair was escaping from its undone plaits in every direction, straggling down my neck in damp, curly strands. I pulled the ribbon off and tried to comb my hair out with my fingers. "What's so important about Josiah Beardsley, anyway?" I asked. "Surely one 14-year-old boy can't make so much difference."
"Beardsley's a hunter," Jamie answered, "and a good one. He brought in nearly 200 weight of wolf, deer and beaver skins to the gathering. All taken by himself alone," he said. "I couldn't do better myself."
That was a true encomium, and I pursed my lips in silent appreciation. Hides were the main, in fact, the only, winter crop of any value in the mountains. We had no money now, not even the paper proclamation money, worth only a fraction of sterling. And without hides to sell in the spring, we were going to have difficulty getting the seed corn and wheat we needed. And if all the men were required to spend a good part of the winter tramping round the colony subduing regulators instead of hunting... Most women on the ridge could handle a gun, but almost none could hunt effectively, as they were tethered to their homes by the needs of their children. Even Bree, who was a very good hunter, could venture no more than half a day's travel away from Jemmy, not nearly far enough for wolf and beaver. I rubbed a hand through my damp locks, fluffing out the loosened strands. All right, I understand that part. Where do the tonsils come in, though? Jamie looked up at me and smiled. Without answering at once, he got to his feet and circled behind me. With a firm hand, he gathered in the fugitive strands, captured the flying bits, and braided it into a tight, thick plait at the base of my neck. He bent over my shoulder, plucked the ribbon from my lap, and tied it neatly in a bow. There. He sat down by my feet again.
Now, as to the tonsils. You told the lad he must have them out, or his throat would go from bad to worse.
It will. Josiah Beardsley had believed me, and having come near death the winter before, when an abscess in his throat had nearly suffocated him before bursting, he was not eager to risk another such occurrence.
You're the only surgeon north of Cross Creek, Jamie pointed out. Who else could do it?
Well, yes, I said uncertainly.
So, I've made the lad an offer, Jamie interrupted. One section of land. We, Roger and myself, will help him to put up a cabin on it when the time comes. And he'll go halves with me in whatever he takes in the way of skins for the next 3 winters. He's willing, provided you'll take out his tonsils as part of the bargain.
But why today? I can't take someone's tonsils out here. I gestured at the dripping forest.
Why not?
Jamie raised one eyebrow.
Did you not see last night it was a small matter? Only a few wee cuts with your smallest knife.
I rubbed a knuckle under my nose, sniffing with exasperation. Look, just because it isn't a massive bloody job like amputating a leg doesn't mean it's a simple matter. It was, in fact, a relatively simple operation, surgically speaking. It was the possibility of infection following the procedure and the need for careful nursing. A poor substitute for antibiotics, but much better than neglect that raised complications.
I can't just whack out his tonsils and turn him loose, I said. When we get back to the ridge, though... He doesn't mean to come back with us directly,
Jamie interrupted.
Why not? I demanded. He didn't see. Only that he had a bit of business to do and would come to the ridge by the first week of December. He can sleep in the loft above the herb shed, he added.
So you and he expect me just to slash out his tonsils, put in a few stitches and see him on his merry way? I asked sardonically.
You did nicely with the dog, he said, grinning.
Oh, you heard about that?
Oh, aye. And the lad who chopped his foot with an axe, and the bairns wee milk rash, and Mrs. Buchanan's toothache, and your battle wee Murray MacLeod over the gentleman's bile ducts.
It was rather a busy morning. I shuddered briefly in remembrance and took another sip of whisky.
The whole gathering is talking of you, Sassenach. I did think of the Bible, in fact, seeing all the crowd clamouring round you this morning.
The Bible? I must have looked blank at the reference, because the grin got wider.
"And the whole multitude sought to touch him," Jamie quoted, "for there went virtue out of him and healed them all."
I laughed ruefully, interrupting myself with a small hiccup. "Fresh out of virtue at the moment, I'm afraid."
"Dinna fash. There's plenty in the flask."
Thus reminded, I offered him the whisky, but he waved it away, brows drawn down in thought. Melting hail had left wet streaks in his hair, and it lay like ribbons of melted bronze across his shoulders, like the statue of some military hero, weathered and glistening in a public park.
So you'll do the lad's tonsils once he comes to the ridge?
I thought a moment, then nodded, swallowing.
There would still be dangers in it, and normally I wouldn't do purely elective surgery. But Josiah's condition was truly dreadful, and the continued infections might well kill him eventually if I didn't take some steps to remedy it.
Jamie nodded, satisfied.
I'll see to it, then.
My feet had thawed, even wet as they were, and I was beginning to feel warm and pliable.
My belly still felt as though I'd swallowed a large volcanic rock, but I wasn't minding all that much. I was wondering something, Sassenach, he said.
Yes?
Speaking of the Bible, you kid.
Got scripture on the brain today, have you?
One corner of his mouth curled up as he glanced at me. Aye, well, it's only I was thinking. When the angel of the Lord comes along to Sarah and tells her she'll have a bairn the next year, she laughs and says that's a rare jest, as it ceased to be wi' her after the manner of women.
Most women in that situation likely wouldn't think it at all a funny idea, I assured him. I often think God's got a very peculiar sense of humour, though.
He looked down at the large maple leaf he was shredding between thumb and forefinger, but I caught the faint twitch of his mouth. I've thought that now and again myself, Sassenach, he said rather dryly. Be that as it may, she did have the bairn, eh?
The Bible says she did. I'm not going to call the book of Genesis a liar. I debated the wisdom of drinking more, but decided to save it for a rainier day, and put the stopper back in the flask. I could hear a certain amount of stirring in the direction of the campsite, and my ears caught a word of inquiry borne on the chilly breeze. Someone's looking for himself, I said. Again.
Himself glanced over his shoulder and grimaced slightly, but made no immediate move to answer the call.
He cleared his throat, and I saw a faint flush move up the side of his neck.
Well, the point is, he said, carefully not looking at me, that so far as I can, if your name's not Mary, and the Holy Ghost isn't involved in the matter, there's only the one way of getting wee child.
Am I right? So far as I knew, yes.
I put a hand over my mouth to stifle a rising hiccup.
Aye. And if so, well, that must mean that Sarah was still bedding wi' Abraham at the time, no?
He still wasn't looking at me, but his ears had gone pink, and I belatedly realised the point of this religious discussion. I reached out a toe and prodded him gently in the side.
You were thinking perhaps I wouldn't want you any more?
You dinna want me now, he pointed out logically, eyes on the crumbled remains of his leaf.
I feel as though my belly is full of broken glass. I'm half-soaked and mud to the knees, and whoever's looking for you is about to burst through the shrubbery with a pack of bloodhounds at any moment, I said, with a certain amount of asperity. Are you actually inviting me to participate in carnal revelry with you in that mound of soggy leaves? Because if you are, no, no, he said hastily.
I didn't mean no. I was only wondering if...
The tips of his ears had gone a dull red. He stood up abruptly, brushing dead leaves from his kilt with exaggerated force. If, I said in measured tones, you were to get me with child at this point in the proceedings, Jamie Fraser... I would have your balls en brochette.
I rocked back, looking up at him.
As for bedding with you, though? He stopped what he was doing and looked at me. I smiled at him, letting what I thought show plainly on my face. Once you have a bed again, I said, I promise I won't refuse it.
Oh, he said.
He drew a deep breath, looking suddenly quite happy.
Well, that's all right then. It's only... I wondered, you ken.
A sudden loud rustling in the shrubbery was followed by the appearance of Mr. Weems, whose thin, anxious face poked out of a nannyberry bush.
"Oh, it's yourself, sir," he said in evident relief.
"I suppose it must be," Jamie said in resignation. "Is there a difficulty, Mr. Weems?"
Mr. Weems was delayed in answering, having become inextricably entangled with the nannyberry bush, and I was obliged to go and help release him. A one-time bookkeeper who'd been obliged to sell himself as an indentured servant, Mr. Weems was highly unsuited to life in the wilderness.
"I do apologise for troubling you, sir," he said, rather red in the face.
He picked nervously at a spiny twig that had caught in his fair, flyaway hair.
"It's only, well, she did say she meant to cleave him from crown to crutch wi' her axe if he didna leave off. And he said no woman would speak to him in that manner. And she does have an axe."
Accustomed to Mr. Weems's methods of communication, Jamie sighed, reached out for the whisky flask, uncorked it, and took a deep, sustaining swig. He lowered the flask and fixed Mr. Weems with a gimlet eye.
"Who?" he demanded.
Did I not see? Rosamond Lindsay and Ronnie Sinclair."
"Mm-hmm."
Not good news. Rosamond Lindsay did have an axe. She was roasting several pigs in a pit near the creek over hickory embers. She also weighed nearly 200 pounds, and, while normally good-humoured, was possessed of a notable temper when roused. For his part, Ronnie Sinclair was entirely capable of irritating the angel Gabriel, let alone a woman trying to cook in the rain. Jamie sighed and handed the flask back to me. He squared his shoulders, shaking droplets from his plaid as he settled it.
"Go tell them I'm coming, Mr. Weems," he said.
Mr. Weems's thin face expressed the liveliest apprehension at the thought of coming within speaking range of Rosamond Lindsay's axe, but his awe of Jamie was even greater. He bobbed a quick, neat bow, turned, and blundered straight into the nannyberry bush again. A wail, like an approaching ambulance, betokened the appearance of Masali, Joan in her arms. She plucked a clinging branch from Mr. Weems's coat sleeve, nodding to him as she stepped carefully round him.
"Da," she said without preamble, "you've got to come. Father Kenneth's been arrested."
Jamie's eyebrows shot up.
"Arrested? Just now? By whom?"
"Aye, this minute. A nasty fat man who said he was sheriff of the county. He came up with 2 men, and they asked who was the priest, and when Father Kenneth said it was him, they seized him by the arms and marched him straight off with none so much as a by your leave."
The blood was rising in Jamie's face, and his 2 stiff fingers tapped briefly against his thigh.
"They've taken him from my half," he said. "Adieu."
This was plainly a rhetorical question, and before Masali could answer it, a crunching of footsteps came from the other direction, and Brianna popped into sight from behind a pine tree.
"What?"
he barked at her. She blinked, taken aback.
"Geordie Chisholm says one of the soldiers stole a ham from his fire, and will you go and see Lieutenant Hayes about it?"
"Yes," he said promptly. "Later. Meanwhile, do you go back with Masali and find out where they've taken Father Kenneth. And Mr. Weems..."
But Mr. Weems had at last escaped the clinging embrace of the nannyberry bush. A distant crashing signalled his rush to fulfil his orders. A quick look at Jamie's face convinced both girls that a swift retreat was the order of the day, and within seconds we were alone again. He took a deep breath and let it slowly out through his teeth. I wanted to laugh, but didn't. Instead, I moved closer. Cold and damp as it was, I could feel the heat of his skin through his plaid.
"At least it's only the sick ones who want to touch me," I said.
I held out the flask to him.
"What do you do when all the virtue's gone out of you?"
He glanced down at me, and a slow smile spread across his face. Ignoring the flask, he stooped, cupped my face in his hands, and kissed me, very gently.
"That," he said.
Then he turned and strode downhill,
presumably full of virtue once more.
Chapter 13. Beans and Barbecue. I took the kettle back to our camp, only to find the place momentarily deserted. Voices and laughter in the distance indicated that Lizzie, Massali, and Mrs. Bug, presumably with children in tow, were on their way to the women's privy, a latrine trench dug behind a convenient screen of juniper, some way from the campsites. I hung the full kettle over the fire to boil, then stood still for a moment, wondering in which direction my efforts might be best directed. While Father Kenneth's situation might be the most serious in the long run, it wasn't one where my presence would be likely to make a difference. But I was a doctor, and Rosamond Lindsay did have an axe. I patted my damp hair and garments into some sort of order and started downhill toward the creek, abandoning the mobcap to its fate. Jamie had evidently been of the same mind regarding the relative importance of the emergencies in progress. When I fought my way through the thicket of willow saplings edging the creek, I found him standing by the barbecue pit in peaceful conversation with Ronnie Sinclair, meanwhile leaning casually on the handle of an axe of which he had somehow managed to possess himself. I relaxed a bit when I saw that and took my time in joining the party, unless Rosamond decided to strangle Ronnie with her bare hands or beat him to death with a ham. Neither of these contingencies being at all unthinkable, my medical services might not be needed after all. The pit was a broad one, a natural declivity bored out of the clay creek bank by some distant flood, and then deepened by judicious spadework in the years succeeding. Judging by the blackened rocks and drifts of scattered charcoal, it had been in use for some time. In fact, several different people were using it now. The mingled scents of fowl, pork, mutton, and possum rose up in a cloud of applewood and hickory smoke, a savoury incense that made my mouth water. The sight of the pit was somewhat less appetizing. Clouds of white smoke billowed up from the damp wood, half obscuring a number of shapes that lay upon their smouldering pyres, many of these looking faintly and hair-raisingly human through the haze. It reminded me all too vividly of the charnel pits on Jamaica, where the bodies of slaves who hadn't survived the rigours of the Middle Passage were burned. And I swallowed heavily, trying not to recall the macabre roasting meat smell of those funeral fires. Rosamond was working down in the pit at the moment, her skirt curtled well above plump knees, and sleeves rolled back to bare her massive arms as she ladled a reddish sauce onto the exposed ribs of a huge hog's carcass. Around her lay five more gigantic shapes, shrouded in damp burlap, with the wisps of fragrant smoke curling up around them, vanishing into the soft drizzle.
"It's poison is what it is," Ronnie Sinclair was saying hotly as I came up behind him. "She'll ruin it. It'll no be fit for pigs when she's done." "It is pigs, Ronnie," Jamie said with considerable patience.
He rolled an eye at me, then glanced at the pit where sizzling fat dripped onto the biers of hickory coals below.
"Myself, I shouldn't think you could do anything to a pig, in the way of cooking, that is, that would make it not worth the eating."
"Quite true," I put in helpfully, smiling at Ronnie. "Smoked bacon, grilled chops, roasted loin, baked ham, head cheese, sausage, sweetbreads, black pudding. Someone once said you could make use of everything in a pig but the squeal."
"Aye, well, but this is the barbecue, isn't it?"
Ronnie said stubbornly, ignoring my feeble attempt at humour.
"Anyone kens that you sass a barbecued hog wi' vinegar. That's the proper way of it. After all, you wouldn't put gravel into your sausage meat, would you? Or boil your bacon with sweepings from the hen-house." Oh.
He jerked his chin toward the white pottery basin under Rosamond's arm, making it clear that its contents fell into the same class of inedible adulterants, in his opinion. I caught a savoury whiff as the wind changed. So far as I could tell from smell alone, Rosamond's sauce seemed to include tomatoes, onions, red pepper, and enough sugar to leave a thick blackish crust on the meat, and a tantalising caramel aroma in the air.
"I expect the meat will be very juicy cooked like that,"
I said, feeling my stomach begin to knot and growl beneath my laced bodice.
Aye, a wonderful fat lot of pigs they are, too,
Jamie said ingratiatingly as Rosamond glanced up, glowering. She was black to the knees, and her square-jowled face was streaked with rain, sweat, and soot.
Will they have been wild hogs, ma'am, or gently reared?
Wild, she said, with a certain amount of pride, straightening up and wiping a strand of wet greying hair off her brow.
Fattened on chestnut mast. Nothing like it to give a flavour to the meat.
Ronnie Sinclair made a Scottish noise indicative of derision and contempt.
Aye, the flavour's so good you must hide it under a larding or yon grisly sauce that makes it look as though the meat's not even cooked yet, but bleeding raw.
Rosamond made a rather earthy comment regarding the supposed manhood of persons who felt themselves squeamish at the thought of blood, which Ronnie seemed disposed to take personally. Jamie skilfully manoeuvred himself between the two, keeping the axe well out of reach.
"Oh, I'm sure it's very well cooked indeed," he replied soothingly. "Why, Mistress Lindsay has been hard at work since dawn, at least." "Long before that, Mr. Fraser," the lady replied with a certain grim satisfaction. "You want decent barbecue, you start at least a day before and tend it all through the night. I've been a-minding of these hogs since yesterday afternoon."
She drew in a great sniff of the rising smoke, wearing a beatific expression.
Ah, that's the stuff. Not but what a savoury sauce like this one is wasted on you bastardly Scots,
Rosamond said, replacing the burlap and patting it tenderly into place.
You've pickled your tongues with that everlasting vinegar you slop on your victuals. It's all I can do to stop Kenny a-putting it on his cornbread and porridge of a morning.
Jamie raised his voice, drowning out Ronnie's incensed response to this calumny.
"And was it Kenny that hunted the hogs for you, mistress? Wild hogs have a chance in nature. Surely it's a dangerous business to be stalking beasts of that size. Like the wild boar that we hunted in Scotland, aye?"
Rosamond cast a look of good-natured scorn toward the slope above, where her husband, roughly half her size, presumably was engaged in less strenuous pursuits.
"No, indeed, Mr. Fraser. I killed this lot myself. With that axe," she added pointedly, nodding toward the instrument in question and narrowing her eyes in a sinister fashion at Ronnie. "Caved in their skulls with one blow, I did."
Ronnie, not the most perceptive of men, declined to take the hint.
"It's the tomato fruits she's using, McDo," he hissed, tugging at Jamie's sleeve and pointing at the red-crusted bowl. "Devil's apples! She'll poison us all!" "Oh, I shouldn't think so, Ronnie."
Jamie took a firm grip on Ronnie's arm and smiled engagingly at Rosamond.
"You mean to sell the meat, I suppose, Mrs. Lindsay? It's a poor merchant that would kill our customers, aye?" "I ain't yet lost a one, Mr. Fraser,"
Rosamond agreed, turning back another sheet of burlap and leaning over to dribble sauce from a wooden ladle over a steaming haunch.
"Ain't never had but good words about the taste, neither," she said, "though, of course, that would be in Boston, where I come from."
"Where folk have sense," her tone clearly implied.
"I met a man from Boston last time I went to Charlottesville,"
Ronnie said, his foxy brows drawn down in disapproval. He tugged, trying to free his arm from Jamie's grip, but to no avail.
"He said to me as it was his custom to have beans at his breakfast and oysters to his supper. And so he'd done every day since he was a wean. I wonder he hadn't blown up like a pig's bladder filled with such wretched stuff as that." "Beans, beans, they're good for your heart," I said cheerily, seizing the opening. "The more you eat, the more you fart. The more you fart, the better you feel, so let's have beans for every meal."
Ronnie's mouth dropped open, as did Mrs. Lindsay's. Jamie whooped with laughter, and Mrs. Lindsay's look of astonishment dissolved into a booming laugh. After a moment, Ronnie rather reluctantly joined in, a small grin twisting up the corner of his mouth.
"I lived in Boston for a time," I said mildly, as the hilarity died down a bit. "Mrs. Lindsay, that smells wonderful."
Rosamond nodded with dignity, gratified.
"Why, so it does, ma'am, and I say so."
She leaned toward me, lowering her voice slightly from its normal stentorian range.
"It's my private receipt what does it," she said, with a proprietorial pat of the pottery bowl. "Brings out the flavour, see?"
Ronnie's mouth opened, but only a small yelp emerged, the evident result of Jamie's hand tightening about his biceps. Rosamond ignored this, engaging in an amiable discussion with Jamie that terminated in her agreeing to reserve an entire carcass for use at the wedding feast. I glanced at Jamie, hearing this. Given that Father Kenneth was probably at present en route either back to Baltimore or to the jail in Edentown, I had my doubts as to whether any marriages would in fact take place tonight. On the other hand, I had learned never to underestimate Jamie either. With a final word of compliment to Mrs. Lindsay, he dragged Ronnie bodily away from the pit, pausing just long enough to thrust the axe into my hands.
"See, that's safe, aye, Sassenach,"
he said, and kissed me briefly. He grinned down at me.
"And where did you learn so much about the natural history of beans, tell me?"
"Brianna brought it home from school when she was about 6, I said, smiling back. "It's really a little song."
"Tell her to sing it to her man," Jamie advised.
The grin widened.
"He can write it down in his wee book."
He turned away, putting a companionable arm firmly about the shoulders of Ronnie Sinclair, who showed signs of trying to escape back in the direction of the barbecue pit.
"Come along with me, Ronnie," he said. "I must just have a wee word with the lieutenant. He wishes to buy a ham of Mistress Lindsay, I think," he added, blinking at me in the owl-like fashion that passed with him for winking.
He turned back to Ronnie.
"But I ken he'll want to hear whatever you can tell him about his da. You were a great friend of Gavin Hayes, no?"
"Oh,"
said Ronnie, his scowl lightening somewhat.
"Aye?"
"Aye. Gavin was a proper man.
A shame about it."
He shook his head, obviously referring to Gavin's death a few years before. He glanced up at Jamie, lips pursed.
"Does his lad ken what happened?"
A tender question, that. Gavin had, in fact, been hanged in Charleston for theft. A shameful death, by anyone's standards.
"Aye," Jamie said quietly. "I had to tell him. But it will help, I think, if you could tell him a bit about his da earlier. Tell him how it was for us there in Ardsmuir."
Something, not quite a smile, touched his face as he looked at Ronnie,
and I saw an answering softness on Sinclair's face.
Jamie's hand tightened on Ronnie's shoulder, then dropped away, and they set off up the hill side by side, the subtleties of barbecue forgotten.
"How it was for us."
I watched them go, linked by the conjuration of that one simple phrase. 5 words that recalled the closeness forged by days and months and years of shared hardship. A kinship closed to anyone who had not likewise lived through it. Jamie seldom spoke of Ardsmuir, neither did any of the other men who had come out of it and lived to see the new world here. Mist was rising from the hollows on the mountain now. Within moments they had disappeared from view. From the hazy forest above, the sound of Scottish male voices drifted down toward the smoking pit, chanting in amiable unison,
"Beans, beans, they're good for your heart."
Returning to the campsite, I found that Roger had returned from his errands. He stood near the fire, talking with Brianna, a troubled look on his face.
"Don't worry,"
I told him, reaching past his hip to retrieve the rumbling tea kettle. "I'm sure Jamie will sort it somehow. He's gone to deal with it."
"He has."
He looked slightly startled.
"He knows already?"
"Yes. As soon as he finds the sheriff, I imagine it will all come right."
I upended the chipped teapot I used in camp with one hand, shook the old leaves out onto the ground, and, putting it on the table, tipped a little boiling water in from the kettle to warm the pot. It had been a long day, and likely to be a long evening as well.
I was looking forward to the sustenance of a properly brewed cup of tea, accompanied by a slice of the fruitcake one of my patients had given me during the morning clinic.
A sheriff?
Roger gave Brianna a baffled look,